Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today, a story about what my guest calls the deadliest artifact in the history of human civilization, the cigarette. Humans today smoke 6 trillion of them each year, and it's estimated to contribute to the deaths of 6 million people a year worldwide, and about 100 million in the last century. Robert Proctor is the professor of the history of science at Stanford University and has written a comprehensive history of the cigarette, albeit with a point of view. The book, Golden Holocaust, Origins of the Cigarette Catastrophe and the Case for Abolition, examines all the technological advances and marketing strategies that led to a huge surge in smoking in the 20th century, as well as how tobacco manufacturers have tried to block the recognition of the tobacco cancer hazards. And he shares previously unpublished information on secret studies by those companies, which shows they knew the risk of smoking far earlier than they ever publicly admitted. Proctor is the author of a number of books on medicine in Nazi Germany, on misleading scientific data. He coined the word agnotology to describe that study of doubt caused by bad scientific data, as well as smoking. In fact, he was the first historian to testify against the tobacco industry. Again, his latest book is titled Golden Holocaust, and he joins us today on Studio Tulsa. Robert Proctor, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Happy to be here, Rich.
Your book, Golden Holocaust, is really about the whole history of everything having to do with the tobacco industry, and especially the advent of cigarettes. Cigarette design, the rhetoric, the science, the marketing surrounding cigarettes, which were first made sexy and adult. But also in the book, you say routine and banal.
Right.
That's an interesting choice of words. What do you mean by routine and banal?
Well, I talk about us living in a world, really, of tobacco exceptionalism. We just take this product for granted as if it's in the Constitution or something, when really it's the deadliest product in the history of human civilization. And it's all around us. It's in our movies. It's on our streets everywhere. And we act like it doesn't exist. And if you were to invent it now, no one would tolerate it.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting you mentioned movies. Movies is probably one of the last places where you will still see somebody smoking a cigarette. Television is pretty much banned smoking. In fact, when you go back, it's sort of a shock now with, you know, Netflix and everything. You can go back and watch old television and you go, wow, look at these guys smoking like chimneys.
That's right. Well, of course, you do have shows like Mad Men. And I mean, you can't watch, watch a night of TV without seeing a fair amount of smoking. It's not in the ads anymore. But as you say, it's a lot in the films, too, and we know there's a long record of the tobacco industry actually paying for implants in the movies.
Well, this book is, how long did it took you, 12 years to write this book?
Yeah, about 12 years, yeah.
And you're looking at every single aspect of the industry, beginning with, I guess, the beginning of using cigarettes as a way of using tobacco. And that really is not that old.
No, it's not that old. I mean, it depends a little bit on how you define a cigarette, because what are we talking about? Is it the paper? Is it the size? I mean, after all, a cigarette is just a little cigar. Or is it the inhalability? And each of those goes back to different dates. And if you go back even to the Mayans or the Mesoamericans, they smoked small cigars, and so you could say those are cigarettes. The paper part seems to come in around the 17th century in Spain, when people would gather up tobacco scraps and then just re-roll them in newspaper, and that's kind of like a cigarette. But it's really the 19th century that it gets going as a gigantic industrial enterprise with the Buck Duke fortune and the invention of mechanized cigarette rolling machines and then mass marketing, and that's when it really, really takes off.
Where it really becomes a major health impact is only in the last, a couple hundred years, and that goes back to the importance of flu curing.
That's right, and it's not even a couple hundred. It's really only about 100 years. What flu curing is, most people don't know this, but a cigarette is not just tobacco rolled in paper. You have to cure it. It's kind of like olives or something like that. You can't just smoke raw tobacco. You cure it, but there are different ways of curing it. So traditional Native American curing, or for pipe or cigar tobacco, was you basically just hang it in a shed, and the sugar content goes from about 25% in the leaf down to about 2% in the leaf. But in the 19th century, they discovered that if you heat the tobacco during curing, you actually kill the enzymatic processes that degrade the sugar, and you trap the sugar, and you end up with a very sugary leaf. About 20% of the tobacco leaf flu cured is sugar. And when you burn that, you get acids, and that counteracts the alkaline nature of the nicotine molecule. And what that means is for the first time in history, you get an inhalable smoke because it's not harsh. It's not alkaline like traditional cigars or pipe tobacco. And so that's why I call the flu curing the deadliest invention in the history of human civilization, because it allowed tobacco smoke to be inhaled. And
cigarettes were consumed prior to that, but it was, I assume the smoke was just sort of held in the mouth.
That's right. It's like cigars or pipe. You would just hold it in your mouth and it wouldn't be inhaled.
So flu curing was the first major aspect of creating this huge cigarette industry. The second was, believe it or not, I hadn't even thought about this till I read about it, matches.
Yeah, we take it for granted that it's easy to make a fire, but until around 1800, the way to make a fire was flint and steel. I mean, it's kind of unbelievable. And so people would keep the home fires burning. That's where that expression comes from. There are parts of England where fires in the hearth hadn't gone out for 100 years. It's actually hard to make fire until the invention of matches in the 1830s and 40s, and that allows you to make fire quickly and instantly, and then eventually you get things like the cigarette lighter. So really before that, it was hard to have a routine use of flammable, you know, tobacco products.
You say matches are important, and then the mechanization of creating cigarettes, because I assume before mechanization, it was a hand-roll situation. Probably you consumed quite a bit less.
Oh, yeah. In fact, just today, if you were to make all the cigarettes made in the U.S. today by the hand-rolling process that was used in the 19th century, it would require 3 million laborers. It would be by far the largest industrial enterprise in the U.S. just to roll them by hand. What happens is James Bonsack in the 1880s invents the automatic cigarette rolling machine, and he's able to produce 100,000 per day, as opposed to, you know, 500 a day that each cigarette girl was cranking out. And so that really revolutionized the process. It dropped the price by about a factor of 10. Cigarettes became extremely cheap, and they were just cranked out, you know, about as fast as you can imagine.
You know, we think of modern marketing as being a major part of the explosion of cigarettes, but were people, even before modern marketing, were they attracted to cigarettes?
Well, there were, to some extent. Cigarettes were much more of a luxury product before modern marketing and the Bonsack machine. They were for dandies. They were for sissies. Sometimes they were viewed as basically like a
the opposite of their marketing.
Yeah, that's right. Well, they eventually come to be, you know, this macho thing, and that's partly in reaction to the whole cancer business. So you get the hard-pack Marlboro Man, you know, John Wayne-type cigarette in the 50s, and that's basically to toughen up against cancer.
Hmm. My guest today is Robert Proctor. He's a professor of the history of science at Stanford University. He's the author of Golden Holocaust, The Origins of the Cigarette Catastrophe and the Case for Abolition. The title gives us a point where you stand, but it is a fascinating book. You know, 6 trillion cigarettes are smoked each year. That's an amazing statistic. Even though when you look at American use, we're well on the downward slide.
Yeah, we're slipping. We only smoke 350 billion cigarettes a year, down from the 1982 peak of 630 billion. But worldwide, it's important to keep perspective that there's 6 trillion cigarettes. That's 350 million miles of cigarettes smoked every year. So you're really talking about a gigantic industrial enterprise.
You know, when we think of consumerism, we think of the United States being this huge consumer, but really, even though, you know, hundreds of billions sounds like a lot, but compared to 6 trillion, that is pretty a small percentage, really.
Yeah, that's right. The big smoker now is China. They smoke about 40% of the world's cigarettes, and they're going to face a massive health epidemic because, you know, the health effects are delayed a couple of decades, and so they're really going to feel it big time.
That's one of the interesting things about one of your charts, which shows this decline of smoking in the United States. Really, lung cancer deaths, we're just now rounding the plateau on that, aren't we, as far as the high?
Yeah, that's right. Given this 20-30 year delay between exposure rates and death rates, we're just coming off it. So we now have about 160,000 lung cancer deaths every year, which is by far and away the largest cancer death source in the U.S. That's way up from what it used to be. Basically, lung cancer was an unknown disease prior to the 20th century, there are only 140 cases of lung cancer known worldwide prior to 1900. In fact, it was such a rare disease that a professor of medicine would bring all his students in if they ever saw one and say, look at this, you may never see another case of lung cancer your whole career. But of course, that skyrockets then in the 20s and 30s and on up to the present.
What's interesting, in the first part of your book, you term it the triumph of the cigarette. You talk about flu curing, but you also talk about the various ways in which cigarettes have been promoted. And we might not think about it too much. Cigarettes were a big part of the Marshall Plan?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I discovered that. If you look at standard histories of the Marshall Plan, they don't mention it. But the fact is that for every $2 in food, there was $1 in tobacco as part of the Marshall Plan. And that was organized by a Senator Robertson of Virginia, who's actually Pat Robertson's father, who basically said, look, if we're going to be helping the Europeans, let's also help the Virginia economy. And so they shipped over $1 billion worth of tobacco the first year of the Marshall Plan and basically addicted Europeans to the American flu-cured style, you know, super deadly mild cigarette.
When you go to Europe, you see cigarette smoking probably more than here in the United States today, a lot of times. Was that always the case, or was it a result of us promoting U.S. tobacco after the war?
It's partly a result of the U.S. tobacco push. The French didn't smoke nearly as much. They didn't inhale as much because they were using black tobacco, which was not typically flu-cured. So a lot of the epidemic is traceable, at least partly, to the Marshall Plan.
Of course, the military also was used in promoting cigarette usage. In fact, I think the belief is that, you know, cigarettes are a mild stimulant of sorts. And in both world wars, they were a ration.
Yeah, it's a big push. You got to remember there were a lot of states that actually banned the sale of cigarettes from 1890 to 1920 as part of Prohibition. The war was a big turning point on that. The cigarettes were given as part of the rations, and you got this whole generation of soldiers coming back who were addicted to cigarettes. But the military story is ongoing. In fact, one of the things that I discovered was that in 1986, the U.S. Navy wanted to go smoke-free, and the tobacco industry heard about this and got their friends in Congress to pass a law requiring all naval ships, to both sell cigarettes and to allow smoking on board. And as a result, U.S. naval submarines didn't go smoke-free until the year 2011. So that's how powerful the industry's been. They've even been able to bully and get their way with the U.S. military.
You mentioned the second addiction of cigarettes is government's addiction to the taxation. How important is taxation to the overall budgets, and how important are those taxes in continuing, I guess, the government's, I would say, reluctance to regulate tobacco?
Yeah, that's absolutely key. I call it the second addiction because governments throughout the world are addicted to the wonderful taxes you can get from tobacco. In the 1880s, American federal government, a third of that was just from tobacco taxes. Mm-hmm. Tobacco taxes were gigantic in the 1930s, 40s. As late as the 1950s, Britain was getting 20% of their entire national revenue just from tobacco taxes. China, in the 90s, when I started working on this, they were getting 12% of their entire government revenue just from tobacco taxes. So it creates a conflict of interest. You know, throughout the world, finance ministers love tobacco and health ministers hate it. And it's what keeps us, you know, addicted to tobacco.
And, of course, along with that, certainly the cigarette industry has influenced government. It's probably playing a role in elections by funding. But it also, the biggest way in which we see it has been marketing. And certainly when you look back at the last part of the mid-century, tobacco marketing was ubiquitous. It was everywhere. It was in sports. It was in television shows. It was product placement, you know, in virtually every segment of society.
That's right. It becomes the biggest advertised product in human history. I mean, it saturates radio and TV. The average American in 1960 was watching 50 hours of tobacco ads, cigarette ads, on television every year. It was a constant drumbeat. And then when it goes off the broadcast media, radio and TV, in 1971 with the broadcast ban, it shifts over into magazines and billboards, but also into movie implants and especially into sports sponsorships. So you have things like NASCAR being sponsored by Winston, and you had Virginia Slims tennis tournament that Billie Jean King was shilling for the industry and actually joins the board of directors of Philip Morris. And Philip Morris really made women's tennis. And so there's basically no sport that wasn't funded by the tobacco industry. And that becomes a gigantic way for them to keep really the image of cigarettes on the air.
Now, most of that has dried up today. Is there certain areas of society where cigarettes are still, the industry is still playing a huge role as far as marketing?
Well, you got to remember, they're still selling 350 billion cigarettes every year, so it's a huge part of society. But they're not allowed to advertise publicly as much. There are some magazines. Mother Jones still has tobacco ads, and Wired has tobacco ads, cigarette ads. So it's actually surprising where you actually do still find it. But a lot of it has shifted overseas, and I think the long-term plan for the U.S. industry is to try to basically pinch off the United States and turn entirely over to the big Asian markets, Eastern Europe, Africa, and they're trying as hard as they can to re-addict those parts of the world.
My guest today is Robert Proctor. He's a professor of the history of science at Stanford University. He's the author of Golden Holocaust, The Origins of the Cigarette Catastrophe and the Case for Abolition. It's published by the University of California Press, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, the second part of the book actually looks at, when did you know that cigarette smoking has a cancer hazard? And the discovering the cancer hazard is interesting to me, that the first hypothesis was as early as 1898.
Yeah, that's right. And, of course, for other things like lip and tongue cancer, it goes back even into the 18th century. But the first suspicion of lung cancer, as you say, is 1898, and it's a German doctor who actually thought it was inhaling the tobacco dust that was causing lung cancer, when really we know it was that those people were smoking more. But lung cancer remains really, really rare. It's not super common until the 1920s and 30s, and that's when you really start getting a big push of doctors to explore this upsurge. I mean, there were a lot of different theories. People thought it was maybe lung cancer was being caused by air pollution or road tar or even racial mixing or infections from the great 1919 flu epidemic or some other, you know, environmental cause. And it's not really until the 1930s and 40s that you start getting epidemiology that starts to nail it down as being cigarettes.
And you said there was a big study in the early 1950s, first big experiments by a paper company, I guess, that created papers for cigarettes that looked at this. And tell us what they found.
Yeah, we forget that every time you smoke a cigarette, you're smoking paper. It's about 5% of the cigarette is actually paper, and it's got ink on it. And one of the theories in the early 50s was, my God, maybe it's not the tobacco, maybe it's actually the paper. Because after all, we don't get lung cancer from cigars, so maybe the paper is what's causing the disease. And actually, that was the theory of Thomas Edison and Henry Ford already around World War One. So the tobacco industry started testing this in the early 50s with a series of secret experiments, and they found that it really was the tobacco and not the paper. And these were the so-called Acusta experiments. They were kept entirely secret, and I'm really first publishing them in my book. And it shows that the tobacco industry, already before the published information, was really aware that this was causing cancer.
And in 1953, I guess the result of the experiment was that cigarette tars caused cancer when smeared on the back of mice at that point.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right. It was part of the experimental evidence. There's really, in the 1950s, is you get this confluence of four different types of evidence showing that it's causing cancer. You get the mouse experiments, some secret, some not secret. You get epidemiology in populations. You get chemical analytics showing actual carcinogens in the smoke, and then you get autopsy studies showing that even in people who die from other causes like auto accidents, that they've got pathological changes in their lungs. And all those things came together and really nailed down the scientific consensus.
And yet the big tobacco industry companies were denying all along, right?
Yeah, they launched, I call it the world's deadliest conspiracy. They met, you know, we know the time and date. They met on December 14th, 1953, all the heads of the families, the tobacco manufacturers, and decided to launch a denial. And so they started saying there's no real proof, it's just statistics, you know, maybe it's genetics, maybe it's a virus, maybe it's something else. And they funded hundreds of millions of dollars of research, basically distraction research, decoy research, filibuster research, to really hide the fact that smoking was killing people, and they never admitted that it was killing people until the new millennium.
What is the attitude of tobacco companies now? Do they do admit that cigarette smoking does cause cancer?
Well, they're very clever about this. They admit it causes cancer, but they don't admit it's killed any number of people. They don't admit it's killed thousands or the reality, which is that it's killed millions. They don't admit they marketed to kids. They don't admit that they lied about the hazards to the public and to Congress. They don't admit really any of the key facts. So they're very, very coy about what they'll actually admit.
My guest today is Robert Proctor. His book is titled Golden Holocaust, Origins of the Cigarette Catastrophe and the Case for Abolition. And before we talk about that case for abolition, one of the things you write about in the book is how carefully and well-designed or craftily designed cigarettes are. 630 different compounds are added to cigarettes. Give us a sense of the additives that are a part of a cigarette that we smoke today.
Yeah, I ran into one document from the secret documents of the industry that talks about how tens of billions of dollars have been spent on cigarette design since the 1950s. And one of those is, as you say, is all kinds of very fancy additives. There's 630 different additives that have been added at one time or another to tobacco, and these range from things like cocoa, which contains theobromine, which is actually a bronchodilator, and helps you make it easier to inhale the tobacco, to things like ammonia, which is a freebasing agent. And the freebasing agents like ammonia or hydroxides of various sorts, diammonium phosphate, those will actually freebase the nicotine and make the nicotine molecule much more potent. They've been adding that since the 1960s. But they even add weird stuff, like one of my favorites is castoreum, which is a secretion from the anal gland of the Siberian beaver. And I'm not really sure why they add that, but you know, there's a long, long list of things they put in, and they're not good.
Do they actually add nicotine to the content to make them more addictive? Because nicotine is the thing that gets people addicted.
They don't actually add nicotine. What they do is they calibrate very carefully the amount of nicotine from the different blends. So basically, it's a highly manipulated, calibrated nicotine delivery system. They calibrate the nicotine delivery to within about 2 decimal points. So a typical cigarette will be, its specs will be that it should be 1.86% nicotine by weight. And that's very carefully calibrated. They don't need to add extra nicotine because they can breed the plants to have however much they want from the beginning. And so they have lots of different ways of actually manipulating both the content of the nicotine and its potency.
Okay, I want to ask you about the last section of the book, which you make the case for abolition. And you say very carefully, abolition, not prohibition. What is the difference in your mind?
Well, I do a lot with history of words in this book because words matter a lot. And, you know, I don't mince words in this book. And the tobacco industry for decades has tried to say that basically cigarettes are, you know, guaranteed in the Constitution and that the right to smoke is basically a right to free speech. And they actually became the biggest distributor of copies of the Bill of Rights and American flags in the 1980s and 90s. And so they've tried to associate smoking with freedom and non-smoking with prohibition. And if you think about it, the opposite of prohibition is freedom, but the opposite of abolition is slavery. So I wanted some sense of differentiating abolition from prohibition. Now, the big, really big difference is that in the 1920s, when we had prohibition of alcohol, that was unpopular. Basically, people liked to drink. Drinking is a recreational drug. But smoking cigarettes is very different. Only about 3% of people who drink alcohol are addicts, but about 90% of people who smoke cigarettes are addicted. It's an addiction as strong as that of heroin or cocaine. And if you do what are called regret studies, you find that almost all people who smoke cigarettes wish they didn't. And that's very different from alcohol. And so there's kind of a, what you might call a different libertarian or civil libertarian logic to alcohol and tobacco. People like to drink. It's a recreational drug. It's more like marijuana in that sense. But smoking, cigarette smokers really dislike the fact they smoke and wish they didn't, and that gives it a different political calculus. And that's why I call it abolition, because the idea is that really the smokers themselves don't like this form of nicotine slavery, and they want to escape from it.
Well, let's talk about practical next steps. You know, most public buildings, increasingly, smoking is now banned not only within the building, but oftentimes around the buildings, the grounds. I noticed one of our university campuses is actually saying on the entire grounds this summer, enacting a ban. What's the next steps, the practical next steps?
Yeah, the bans on where you can smoke are extending into bigger and bigger areas. California now has about 150 miles of smoke-free beaches. New York City and other places are getting public parks smoke-free. There are a lot of housing units, residential attached housing units are banning smoking because it seeps in through the vents and things like that. So that's going to be one thing that continues. A lot of places, employers are starting to not hire smokers. There are a lot of restrictions on where you can sell cigarettes. I think these are going to be folded together into more general bans. And this is one of the things that people don't realize is that every community, every state, every city council actually has the power to ban the sale of cigarettes. And that has actually been upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court in Austin versus Tennessee in 1900. Supreme Court ruled that every state had that power. And I think that's what's going to happen, is we're going to start to see small communities banning the sale of cigarettes, and that's going to spread.
Let me ask you, that's been over 100 years since that precedent. Has there been any challenges to that since?
No, not since. No, it's never been successfully challenged.
It would be very interesting to see how today's courts would look at that issue, though. I have to say.
Yeah. Well, there are, you know, local places are starting to ban the sale of tobacco. You know, you can ban it on a university campus, things like this. So there seems to be no impediment to it.
All right. Well, the name of the book, it's a big book, a big tome on everything having to do with the cigarette industry. Golden Holocaust is the name of the book. Robert Proctor, my guest. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Robert Proctor is the author of Golden Holocaust, The Origins of the Cigarette Catastrophe and the Case for Abolition. He's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. Whether it's to keep up with the latest news or to see the latest edition of Studio Tulsa or something from our archives, visit our website at publicradiotulsa.org for the latest information, as well as old Studio Tulsas as well. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.